It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, ready for a new year, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Is it like new music for the new year? Is that the idea?
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Just because I couldn't find the other CD. So it's one of those technical glitches.
here at Mind Over Matters, where we are our crack producing team each week. There are hundreds of people behind the scenes who help you hear what you hear each and every week.
Someday we're going to let some of them in.
Yes. They're out there in the cold right now, shivering. We don't pay them either. It's really kind of sad. But.
No, it's like Eat the State, where it's all volunteer. Let's jump into this week's...
We are looking at outsourcing to India, however.
Considering that.
Although I don't think they're ready to work for free.
No, not quite. Almost. So let's jump right in.
Let's jump right into the angry, drooling bovine situation.
The irritated cows?
Yes.
As opposed to mad cows. I think the two big bits of news on that this week are that...
Can we avoid the word bits, by the way?
Ground up bits of news this week.
Yes.
The USDA had said initially that they were testing all downer cows that were going for slaughter in the United States. And then when they were pressed for details, they said this week, well, last year that they tested somewhere around 20 to 21,000 cows. Now, this is after they had admitted that about 150,000 to 200,000 downer cows get slaughtered in the United States every year. So I looked at that and I said, wait a second. The USDA last year tested only 21,000 downer cows, and yet they're saying 150,000 to 200,000 are going for slaughter every year. There doesn't seem to be a match between those two numbers. So really, they just admitted this week that they only test about 10% of the downer cows that are going into slaughterhouses and parts of which are going into the human food chain. So they really have not got a clue whether or not we've been exposed to mad cow disease.
And particularly when you're talking about, you know, one cow out of a huge population. Now, we're talking about this out of a population of 100 million cattle in the U.S. in any given year. I think it was 96 million last year.
And downer cows are only...
So they're not testing any of the rest of the cattle.
Right. And downer cows are only those animals that exhibit symptoms. Possible symptoms of mad cow disease. Now, another statistic that I saw is that most of the animals, about 80% of the animals that get slaughtered, are under 30 months of age. So they're under 2.5 years of age. Now, that means they're not old enough to exhibit symptoms of mad cow disease, which take about 5 to 7 years to show up in a cow. Now, you might say, well, that means that these animals are too young to be infected. That is not a valid assumption, because these animals may still have the prion, the little protein that is causes mad cow disease, may still be in their bodies, just at a level that is not showing symptoms or is harder to detect by the tests that we have nowadays.
Yeah, and so what you get with this, several things, and all of which are pretty appalling. One is that most cattle are slaughtered before the age where symptoms can be described. So most of them are not going to be in the downer cow population. That most of them are slaughtered at 4 or 5 years of age at most. Now, this is in contrast with Japan, where they test every cow, with Europe, where they don't test the cows, but they test every cow over, 1 or 2 years of age, I think. In the U.S., they test very, very few, and it's pretty easy to understand why, because the regulatory system has been taken over by big agribusiness. You have a Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Veneman, who is a former beef industry lobbyist, and who also has been, in her prior career, a lobbyist for genetically engineered foods as well. So, I mean, you know, she's had the worst of both worlds. You have had, and it's not just the Bush administration, although the Bush administration is most egregious. You have had a regulatory structure over the last 15, 20 years since you had the initial epidemic in Britain where, you know, people could see this coming. People could see it coming since last summer when there was a mad cow case in Canada, and cattle can move back and forth freely across the border due to free trade, where, you know, this should have set alarm bells going, but it didn't because of the way that the regulatory system is dominated by big agribusiness.
Right, and there are some other issues, too. Just because we process so much meat and Americans eat so much meat, there are some shortcuts that the industry has taken in order to make it economical to raise large numbers of animals. Excuse me. One of the main shortcuts is the way that calves are separated from cows at birth. That's done on family farms as well, but much of the time they are sold off or they're taken to a separate facility or a separate farm where they are fed not cow milk, which is their natural diet, but they're fed milk replacer. And the milk replacer, because it is not as nutritious as the cow's own milk, it contains various supplements in it. One of those supplements is freeze-dried cattle blood. So in essence, you're feeding these calves the way that cannibals would eat. You're feeding them parts of dead cattle. Now, many experts say, well, there's no proof that mad cow disease can be transmitted by feeding blood to calves. However, we know that last month a man in Britain died having contracted Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, the human form of mad cow disease, from the British blood supply through a blood transfusion. So there's a real question there as to whether that practice, which is very common in the United States, is one that should be discontinued. Now, there's also another thing that came to light this week, too, is that I think I had talked last week about how chickens are fed parts, cattle scraps, particularly from the brain and spinal cord tissue of cows, and that those prions in mad cow disease, they're not absorbed by the chicken's digestive tract, but passed through into the chicken manure, and then the chicken manure can be used as organic fertilizer. Now, I didn't know this last week, but this has come out in some of the questioning of the USDA on this topic by reporters, that chickens are fed cattle parts, and then chicken manure can be turned around and fed back to cows. That's not something that I had known, but that's not part of the feed ban, so chicken manure is often, not often, but is sometimes scooped right back into the human food supply system through that route.
Yeah,
as well.
What this basically means is that the banning of the use of downer cows in the human food chain is a public relations ploy, because all they're doing instead, they're going to feed it to chickens, the chickens are going to poop it, it's going to be fed back to the cattle, and then we'll eat it that way. You know, it'll take a couple, three more steps, but it's not as though in those steps the prions or any other disease vector, for that matter, is going to magically disappear. These are living organisms. They don't spontaneously appear or spontaneously disappear, as our regulatory system seems to think that they do. I mean, you know, these are diseases. They have vectors.
All right. Anything else on that?
Now let's move on.
All right. Well, I just got to throw in one thing. The one of the things they're proposing now to make us all feel better is they say they're gonna tag the cows with the little electronic
microchips
in their ears and
yeah.
stuff. I think it would be actually a better idea if we actually tag all the USDA inspectors, and then we can track where they go, and we can see if they're actually doing they're supposed to do.
That was another complaint too, is that the USDA inspectors don't test any of the equipment or test the feed that moves through the food mills to make sure that there isn't cross contamination or contamination by bits of cattle tissue that shouldn't be in cattle feed. What they do is they just walk through the plants and talk to the people who work there and do a paper inspection. They look at the records in the office, and that's about all they do.
Yeah, and these are inspections that are notified in advance. They're not surprise inspections at
yeah.
all. The companies have plenty of time to prepare their little, you know, Tompkin feed lots for the benefit of the inspectors.
All right. Well, let's Let's do something we normally don't do. Let's inject a little bit of good news into our our half hour.
Oh, we're going to the oil spill next, are we?
No, actually, we're going to Hanford.
Oh, okay.
Let's go over to...
A measure that is tentatively called I-297. It's an initiative that may get another number once it is processed by the Secretary of State. But Jerry Paulette and our good friends over at Heart of America Northwest and some of the other activist groups, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Peace Action of Washington, and some of the other groups that that have helped put this together, is an initiative that will appear on the ballot later this year, 2004, challenges and actually bans the plan of the federal government to import most, if not all, of the country's low-level nuclear waste to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Now, this is something that has been a long time in coming, and we've talked about this on this program for a number of years, where Hanford is basically the biggest environmental catastrophe in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, they're really, when you're talking about nuclear contamination of a site, there are some places in the Ural Mountains that the old Soviet Union managed to foul worse than what has been done at Hanford. But that's really about it on a global scale. There are a number of tanks out there at Hanford where not only are they not being cleaned up, but they don't even dare go in to try and figure out what's there in order to figure out how to clean it up because it's simply too dangerous. It's a toxic stew, and it's a toxic stew that's eating through the lining of the containers and the tanks. In many cases, it's already seeped into the groundwater, and we're talking about...
into the Columbia River.
Yeah, only a few hundred yards from the Columbia River. It's a total mess out there. Now, by law, the Department of Energy, which is the federal agency that has control over Hanford, and then they subcontract that out to various private contractors, is required to clean this up. It's through something called the Tri-Party Agreement between the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Washington State Department of Ecology. However, the DOE, that is the federal DOE, the Department of Energy, does not routinely even ask Congress for enough money to meet its cleanup deadlines. It's not even a case of Congress not giving them enough money. They don't even ask for it. And the money that is used, frequently goes into overhead and administrative costs for the private contractors. I mean, it is a corrupt mess, and it's been a mess for many years. So that when you had this week the signatures being filed on this, and it was really a pleasant surprise for activists because they didn't know really right up until the last week as the petitions were being turned in whether they were going to have enough signatures to get on the ballot or not. They were way, way over target. This is going to be on the ballot. It's pretty clear. So you had the politicians and the various business interests in the Tri-Cities scrambling, and there was one priceless quote in the newspaper this morning saying something, well, this is a much more complex issue than these people are making it out to be. Cleanup at Hanford is a tremendously complex issue, and the reason it's complex is the people have not been doing their legally mandated duties to try and clean this stuff up for the last 30 or 40 years, really. It has gotten to be a mess out there. But one thing that is very, very clear is that the Bush administration and the Department of Energy's plan to import the rest of the country's low-level nuclear waste to Hanford is going to make a bad situation much, much worse. And that is what this initiative is targeted at. The campaign will be revving up as of this point, and it really is a tremendous opportunity for activists in this state, both people who are concerned about the environment, people who are concerned about the military-industrial complex, about the nuclear proliferation and the use of nuclear energy, and all of these different issues tied together at Hanford. It's a tremendous opportunity to take those questions to the state's voters, where, I think voters will be much more receptive to that than lawmakers and the bureaucrats at the DOE have been over the past number of years. So, yeah, very good news.
All right. Well, speaking of cleanup, it looks like they're trying to do some specific cleanup on Puget Sound.
Yes, just this past week there was an oil spill at a fuel transfer depot in Edmonds, just north of Seattle. And in a matter of hours, the oil that spilled into the Puget Sound swept across the sound because, as most environmentalists know, but most politicians and local officials don't know is that even on a night that doesn't have a lot of wind, the Puget Sound has a lot of currents, and it takes...
They're called tides.
Tides. Yeah. And it takes things very, very quickly and spreads them around the sound. In this case, it spread the oil across, clear across the sound in just a matter of a couple of, just a matter of a few hours, and contaminated shellfish beds that are owned by the Suquamish tribe. Now, this
is
area,
on the Kitsap Peninsula.
Yeah, and this area is known to be very fertile marshland, and it provides breeding grounds for salmon, herring, Dungeness crab, clams, and also they said this week that there were eagles that were feeding off of some of the contaminated shellfish. There's also the orca. The resident orca pod has a new calf this year, and they're worried that the whales will have been exposed to the contamination as well. It's just become a terrible issue of how to clean this up.
Yeah, it's an area that is so rich and so fertile, and I don't know which is the cause and which is the effect, but it's considered sacred to the Duwamish tribe, this particular area, and is tremendously important economically also with the shellfish harvest there. It's tragic,
right,
that it happened to wash up on this particular stretch of shoreline.
So far, the company that was responsible has spent about $1 million to clean it up, but that's just the short-term cleanup, just picking up the heavy fuel that's on top of the waves. They're not going to even bother with the lighter fuel, and that is going to have a long-term impact that's pretty bad. Particularly for the shellfish beds there. Now, there's also questions of why they didn't deploy booms when they were fueling the barge. Now, the oil spilled because a worker who was pumping oil into a barge basically left his post and went into the office to do a little bit of paperwork and didn't notice that the tank that he was filling up on the barge had overflowed, until alarms went off and a certain amount of oil had already spilled into the sound. Now, there's a question as to why this refueling depot, which in the past, when Chevron was managing this refueling or fuel transfer point, when they were managing it in the past, they had deployed booms anytime a ship was being refueled there, or a tanker or a barge was taking on fuel. But that didn't happen the night that the spill occurred. So there's a question as to why that practice has stopped, and why also that there's no legislation in place that would have required that to be the case, that any time a ship is taking on fuel at a refueling or a fuel transfer station, why they don't automatically deploy the booms.
Yeah. One of the things that, and this gets to a number of larger environmental issues involving oil in the Puget Sound and the Strait of Juan de Fuca as well, and the real, real serious risk, which many environmentalists have been aware of for years, of oil spills in this region, that you have a tremendous amount of oil coming down from Alaska that is piped through to the Midwest and points east of here, through Cherry Point, through the refinery at Anacortes, a great deal of oil that is shipped through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and there's been controversy over the years over the Coast Guard having tugboats that accompany this, over the use of single as opposed to double thickness hulls, any number of different types of protections against what could be devastating oil spills in the Puget Sound. And this was a relatively quote-unquote minor oil spill, even though the damage was certainly non-minor.
It was about the amount of oil that they could pump in about a minute and a half.
Yeah, so you look at that,
so
compared to the
very brief and very small spill.
Yeah, compared to the amount of oil that could spill with any kind of a large disaster, and you look at the way that protections against this sort of thing happening have you know, once again been contaminated. It's almost like the regulatory structure has been eaten away at by these little prions that are you know, turning regulators' brains into spongy material. It really is a disaster waiting to happen, and hopefully this relatively minor but still tragic incident will reinvigorate that debate a little bit.
All right, well, let's move along. Moving to international issues, let's find out what happened this week in Iraq.
last week in Iraq.
Okay, it's the,
speaking of where the oil comes from.
Yeah. That's right. Let's talk a little bit about where that oil comes from. It's the end of 2003 and the beginning of 2004, so I thought I would give... It's a, actually a good time to look at some year-end totals, particularly casualty figures. I just wanted to give people a little information on how many U.S. troops and how many Iraqi civilians died this year in Iraq. The Iraqi civilian death toll... from the website www.iraqbodycount.org puts the total of Iraqi civilian dead, and this is a very conservative figure, at 7,960 people up to 9,792. U.S. casualties in Iraq since May 1st, 2003 are at 343 total. That's not just the combat figures. That includes people who died when their vehicles turned over or fell into a canal, etc. Since the war began, that number is 482 U.S. soldiers dead. Since Saddam's capture, 27 U.S. soldiers have died. Other coalition troops since the war began... The coalition dead, that includes Bulgarians, Thais, Polish soldiers, British troops, etc., are 93. And 13 journalists died last year covering the Iraq War. Now, the United Press International reported on December 19th that the U.S. military has made 11,000 medical evacuations from Iraq. This is regarding the wounded figure, the much-disputed wounded figure that the Pentagon puts out. Their official figure is 2,273 U.S. troops wounded and 364, quote, non-hostile wounded, end quote. Now, UPI received data from the Army Medical Command as of November 30th that showed that 8,581 there were 8,581 medical evacuations for, quote, bone injuries, surgeries, brain problems, heart illness. Now, we're talking about people in their 20s here. Heart illness, mental problems, and other non-hostile causes, end quote.
What was the brain thing again?
Brain problems.
Brain problems.
Not very specific, are they? 8,581 medical evacuations that the Pentagon is not counting, and the Army Medical Command is using this kind of vague terminology to make us think that these are just, spontaneous illnesses, kind of like Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease is just sort of a spontaneous disease.
So would you add that on to the 11,000?
No, that is included in the 11,000. The UPI added that 8,581 to the other figures from the Pentagon and said that it's about 11,000 medical evacuations. So we can really look at that and say, okay, because U.S. troops are over there, because of the war, that these medical evacuations are wounded or as a result of the war, regardless of the cause. And UPI is saying that it's really 11,000 wounded, not the 2,273 that the Pentagon says.
And it's not just UPI. I mean, there have been a number of other sources, both domestic and foreign, who have put the figure at a much, much higher than the Pentagon has said.
Right. And another kind of interesting casualty figure that came out in the Washington Post this week is that the number of U.S. troops killed and wounded in Iraq has more than doubled in the past 4 months over the previous 4 months. Now, what they're saying is that from September 1st to December 26th, about 145 troops were killed and 1,209 were wounded. That's the official number of wounded. That doesn't count, you know, these suicides, et cetera. For May 1st through August 30th, only 65 troops were killed and only 574 were wounded. So that gives you some idea of what the security situation, where that's headed. It's not headed in the good direction. It's headed in the worst direction. Now, they also point, Washington Post also pointed out that both of these four-month periods were far worse than the 6 weeks of major combat operations.
Yeah, and you contrast this, you have had at a number of points along the way, both Pentagon and the people in the Bush administration saying, well, we've turned the corner, well, it's going to get better after here, where the, you had this after the shooting of Saddam's sons, saying, well, that will take the heart out of the resistance because these are all bitter enders. You had it after Saddam's capture. You know, all of these, it really is a state of chronic denial among certainly for public consumption. Now that you can debate whether behind the scenes they're quite as oblivious as they're as what they claim to be in terms of recognizing the situation there. But you know, this is a resistance that is not going to go away very soon. It's a war that's going to be with us for some time to come,
right?
Probably until the Americans leave.
I just wanted to go over this week's dead. Included 13 killed and 35 wounded in multiple suicide bombing attacks in the Shiite Muslim holy city of Karbala. Among the dead were 4 Bulgarian troops, 2 Thai soldiers, and 7 Iraqis. A car bomb exploded in an upscale Baghdad restaurant on New Year's Eve, killing 8 people and wounding 30. The restaurant, which was popular with foreigners in Baghdad, was packed when the bomb exploded, and among the wounded were 3 journalists from the Los Angeles Times. At the time of the explosion, there were 11,000 Iraqi police officers patrolling the streets of Baghdad, and however, they were unable to prevent this attack from happening. Now, on Friday, guerrillas posing as journalists shot down yet another U.S. helicopter near Fallujah. Also, 3 people were shot dead and 30 were injured during a demonstration in Kirkuk in northern Iraq.
Shot dead by whom?
Now, I'm getting to that. There have been rival demonstrations in the city there in recent weeks by both Kurds, who want to set up an autonomous republic in northern Iraq, and by ethnic Arabs and Turkmen who want Kirkuk to remain a part of Iraq and not be part of an autonomous republic. Kirkuk is the main city in the northern oil region, and during the 1970s, Saddam Hussein settled a lot of Arabs there to work the oil fields and to maintain control of the region. Now we're starting to see ethnic infighting, and there's some question as to who actually shot whom on Friday, whether it was Kurdish Peshmergas who were shooting at ethnic Arabs or whether it was Iraqi police who tried to get in between the two groups and stop the fighting, and whether they simply were a bit too trigger happy.
Yeah, and this is the type of infighting that the intelligence and people in the first Bush White House in the early 90s, this was the reason they decided not to continue with the Gulf War and go into Iraq, is precisely this kind of scenario.
Right. Now, and just to wrap things up, I wanted to just talk a little bit about what we might be looking at ahead in 2004 for Iraq. Some of the things to keep an eye on include the continuing guerrilla warfare, to see whether those attacks go up or go down. And I just want to remind folks that so far it's resembling the early stages of the Vietnam War. Another thing to keep an eye on is, will the U.S. be able to actually get the northern oil fields working again to get the oil pipelines flowing, not just for export, but for the domestic supply as well, because there have been shortages of gas in places like Baghdad and other major cities. A country that has a lot of oil reserves, but so far, because of mismanagement and sabotage, they haven't been able to even supply the domestic population. And then we also want to keep an eye on the reconstruction money, the $20 billion that the U.S. voted for reconstruction in Iraq. Where is that going to go? Whose pockets is it going to line? Is it going to go to U.S. contractors, Saudi contractors, Kuwaiti contractors, or is it going to go to some local Iraqi subcontractors to help their economy get jump-started? And are the Iraqi people going to get anything out of the so-called reconstruction money? That's another question, too. And then finally, something that we need to keep an eye on is now that the UN is meeting with Iraqi governing council members to try to set up elections for an interim legislature to take over from the U.S. in 2004, is that going to cause a split in the governing council, since the U.S. is supporting the governing council members who want to do a selection process versus an election process? That's something to keep an eye on in the future.
All right, we're running pretty tight on time. I know you'd wanted to mention Afghanistan this week, but if we can
talk about it next week.
All right, we'll push that into next week then. So, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and perhaps you could share with listeners where exactly they could find Eat the State.
Well, you can find it in your hearts and in your souls. You can also find it if you're
your
a little
food.
Bit less. Yeah. We grind up little bits of it and then refeed it. Yes, you can. Well, first it goes into the bird cages, and from there you see now it is a newspaper. It comes out every couple of weeks, free of charge. You can find it places like bookstores and cafes where you find your free reading material. You know, the bathrooms of people's friends' houses. Maybe. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. The current issue is just going up with the most overhyped and underreported stories of 2003 and much more information on the aggravated cow disease. And you can also find all the back issues there. And if you have story tips, you'd like to volunteer, because that is much of how Eat the State comes out, is volunteer help and energy. Once again, for 2004, our eighth year. If you'd like to have feedback on anything you've heard here or read in the paper, our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.